so much for rejoining us at Out of the Main. I am one of your co-hosts, Tom Nixon, and my other co-host is here, or my only co-host, John, that's you. Question, do you think we're going beast mode today?
Oh my gosh, that was such a great video. I don't know if he knows about that, but yes, we're going to sail another trip around Cape Horn, are we not?
We are. You remembered all the puns from before.
I do.
Well, we are very excited because we have a guest on today, and the silliness that we're referring to was a prior episode we did about the genius that is Jerry Hay, and today we are talking to the genius that is Jerry Hay. Welcome, everyone, to Out of the Main, Jerry Hay. Jerry, welcome so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know if your ears have been burning for the last 3 to 5 years, but if they are, have been,
yeah,
it's probably because your name has probably been evoked hundreds of times on this podcast. So.
Yeah, we've made a bunch of nicknames that I don't know if they're all appropriate or what, but what do you got? The Say Hey Kids, Jerry Hay and the Boys. We've got, I don't know, we've made up nicknames for you because we talk about you so much.
Love it. Love it.
Yeah, so we did actually, I don't know if you're aware of this, but we did a whole episode devoted to your sort of Yacht Rock-centered career, and we, a number of times, we had questions in our head, John, we're like, what do you think the approach was there? And we thought, well, maybe someday we could get Jerry on to talk about it, and here we are.
Yeah, it's a little bit different because our focus, when we got into Yacht Rock, we didn't know where it was going to take us. But our focus ended up being really drilling down in on the session musicians, you know, what their process was. We've talked to like Marty Walsh and Jay Graydon, and what are you presented with when you're called in on a session? This is obviously a bit different because not only are you called in as a session player, but you're also an arranger. And eventually, I want to get to how you got started in that and how that changed as you sort of established yourself. But let's go back to the very beginning. So, Seawind Horns, if you can give us a little background on that.
So, I went to school, a college at Indiana University, and met a trumpet player, Larry Hall. And he and I became best friends immediately, and great trumpet player, and you know, kind of led me down the right path of trumpet at school. He happened to be 2 years older than I was then, and he left school and went to Hawaii, and then called me up one day, kind of in the middle of a lesson, and said, "Do you want to come over to Hawaii? We need that. That we're doing some work here and we need more trumpet players over here." And I said, "Yeah, okay."
Hawaii and work. Yeah,
why not? Yeah, exactly. So, in addition to me, there was Kim Hutchcroft, who plays saxophone in Seawind, and Larry Williams, who plays keyboard and sax in Seawind and a whole bunch of other things. They were also at Indiana. They came over to Hawaii. So we started in Hawaii in 71 playing together. We formed a band just to play what we wanted to play on the weekends. And we played freebies and parks and around, and sort of the beginning of Seawind. Gary Grant, sort of the other trumpet player, was sort of involved in that. And, so it just kind of evolved from there, and Seawind formed because we wanted to try doing some more of our own music and play more as a group.
And that was music to make music. So you were making your living how during that time, doing sessions?
Well, no, there were no sessions per se in Hawaii, but there were like Vegas-type shows.
Okay.
So, you know, we played, I don't know, 6 months of Vegas type shows, and then the band would play like 6 months of in a real small club. You know, not making any money, but kind of perfecting the craft.
And living in Hawaii, so that's not horrible.
And yeah, it was just a great move going over there, and just, you know, was a beach. And then Seawind rehearsal, play the gig, go home, sleep, then repeat. You know, so there was nothing wrong with that.
No.
So then, as long as we're starting with the history, let's maybe fast forward to 1976, where you find your way to L.A. How does that happen, and where does the story go from there?
We're playing in, Seawind is playing in clubs over there, and when guys from L.A., you know, session musicians from L.A. would like be going to Japan, and they would stop over in Hawaii, and they would come and hear us. But we had a lot of people come and hear us. Jeff Carl sat in, Neil Schoen, Abraham Laboriel, Harvey Mason Jr., Harvey Mason Sr. heard us play, said, well, you guys need to move to LA and I'll see what I can do to, you know, try to get a record deal so that we can make that happen. And he did. And he was our producer on our first two records. So that's why we moved to LA in 76.
And so you're in LA as pursuing a career as Seawind.
As Seawind.
Right.
Okay.
And then at what point, I think it's maybe Quincy maybe becomes aware of you, or what point do you then be identified as, wait a minute, we got to bring these guys on as the Cats?
Let me, before leading into that, so as Seawind, you obviously are the horn lead, are you the lead trumpet player?
The only trumpet.
Oh, the only trumpet player at the time. So you're doing the arrangements at that time, and that's part of the craft that you're developing? Or is it more kind of everybody figures it out?
No, well, for the most part, I was doing it. It kind of evolved from when we were first starting out and we were playing top 40 stuff. I would have to take the horn parts off the record. So it kind of evolved from that.
So I wondered if being this lead arranger guy, which obviously you got known for, and eventually we'll get to the Tom's question about Quincy, this being an arranger thing was not something necessarily in your DNA early. It kind of developed as your career developed?
Yeah, never. I didn't ever study it or anything. It just sort of happened because when we moved to L.A., Seawind was playing at the Baked Potato for, I don't know, we played one or two nights a week for a couple of years. People would come in to hear us, and they would come up to me and say, you know, we want to have you guys, the horns, come in and play on our record. Okay, who's going to do the arranging? Well, you are. Okay, so it just kind of, evolved into that.
Yeah, because some of the arrangements you do, they're so outrageous. They feel like they break the rules. And so maybe that's good that you didn't have the schooling in it. So going to Tom's question about Quincy.
So we were, as I said, playing at the Baked Potato. And as Quincy always does, he's somehow finds the new talent before anybody else. And he called me up. We'd only been in town, I don't know, 3-4 months. Phone rings at home. Who knows how he got my phone number? But, you know, he calls it, Jerry, this is Quincy Jones. I want you to come in and play on a record. Great.
You know, you hung up and said, no way.
wrong number. Yeah. No. And he said, and I want you to do the chart too. Okay. I don't know how any of that happened, but, you know, I did. It wasn't much, but, you know, it was that first foot in the door. And he liked it. So, you know, that was kind of the beginning.
Did you have time to work up the chart, or did you just kind of have to do it on the fly? Okay, see you tomorrow, have a chart with you.
No, you know, I've done that a lot, but yeah. He sent me, you know, back then in the day, it was a cassette. Send me a cassette of the track and do your thing. And so, you know, I went in. Quincy said, okay, you know, you get your guys, I'd like to have Snooky Young play with you. Snooky's like my hero lead trumpet player, you know, so in town, and the first big session that I do is with Snooky Young. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's great.
Wow. Well, speaking of Quincy and cassettes, I have to play something. Hopefully I can play this down the line so this will work for any YouTube audience. But there's this file that's made its way around the web quite a bit, and somebody sent this to me, and it goes back to your days of Quincy with Michael Jackson. So I want to play this for you and see if you can give us any background on what this is.
Thank you.
So that obviously sounds like a quick cassette sort of edit. What can you tell us about that?
So we you know, this working day and night, Michael.
Yeah.
And
right.
So, you know, my vision was, okay, working day and night, it's got to be busy. How can mm-hmm. I do that? Make it busy. So if you listen to the beginning of the song, Michael does some like mouth percussion stuff and he goes, so, okay, that's kind of cool. So that became in my part. So then I took that part and the other side is every other 16th note.
Like the saxes that are below that.
It's yes. Well, it's saxes and trumpets. It's
okay.
It's all unison on the da 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 that part, and then the other part is like rhythm kind of horns playing that, and then that's how it gets that. So we recorded. We tried recording to the track to do that. It's very difficult to make it each part line up so that it so we played it for a few times, you know, one track, and then tried to play the other part, and it wasn't ever really lining up right, you know. Wasn't feeling right. So we played to drums only.
Oh,
JR, you know, uh-huh. rock solid.
Yes.
So we played to him drums on our phones only to make sure the time was right. So that's the only way you can get that to line up so that it's
tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick-a. And you still did it as two separate parts, like one part?
Yeah, two separate parts.
And the cassette was what? A way to sort of show Quincy your idea?
No, the cassette is, so we recorded the tune. You know, we must have listened to it like 10 times. Quincy loved it. And so I went to Bruce, the engineer, and I said, any chance of getting a copy of this and solo up the horns?
Oh, okay.
So he said, sure. And so there are four or five different ways that he broke it down. One time's with a hand claps, and one time the one part starts out. And so that's what that's a cassette from the very session.
Wow. There's a cat online that put that arrangement back together one horn at a time on YouTube and shows how. I don't know if you've seen that. It's pretty interesting.
I may have. But it's, you know, with Pro Tools now, that's much easier to do.
Well,
that's why we marvel.
That was kind of be my question, is we marvel how, you know, late 70s, early 80s, how tight these parts are. Almost to the point, you know, when I was younger, I think in the back of my mind, I just figured that was always just kind of horns, like synth horns on the Thriller album. I mean, they can't be real. Nobody can do that.
Nobody can play like that. I know.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So, the marvel is just, it's a miracle to behold. But the question is, how many takes would it take a group to get a horn track that was usable by Quincy without any bleed and anyone's early or nobody's late, without Pro Tools, of course?
I was basically in charge of kind of making sure we were together and everything was in tune and in time and, you know, besides the fact that whether Quincy likes it or Michael likes it or, you know.
Yeah, you got to like it first, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, the tightness, I guess, is kind of on me, because I would, if it wasn't good enough, I'd want to do it again. You know, sometimes, of course, you know, Bruce would say, you know, I need another, you guys need another one. Or Quincy would say, you know, yeah, let's do that again. Or, you know, he'd have another idea of something. But generally it was, you know, it was my doing to make sure that we were good enough.
Well, that's such a common thread in so many of the arrangements that we have found from you, is how your approach is obviously tight from a performance perspective, but as an arranger and an idea, there's so much tight staccato, very difficult, like precise articulations, and you're screaming, whoever is the screamer up top, but it's so aggressive. Your approach is so easy to recognize because it's got this staccato, it's got this tight, it's got this aggressiveness, like it wants to blow your hair back. Who is, so it's a two-part question. Who is the screamer in the group? And
easy.
Is there any influence from Maynard Ferguson in your repertoire?
That's not where I thought the question was going. Interesting.
Okay.
I did listen to Maynard Ferguson, but, you know, it was never really my style. And depending on what we're doing, what the song is, Gary Grant was on most everything I did. He plays some, I play some. With the Giroux stuff, there were three trumpets Chuck Finley played. He plays some, I play, Gary plays some. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, we're throwing it around. Who's, you know, it's, I'll play it, and then who's ever next plays the next one. So it wasn't like, you know, okay, you got this, you know, you're doing all of this one, with just whatever came up.
Okay. So there was no specific first trumpet in the gang. Were you guys hired as a gang, or was it like you were hired, given the job to arrange, and then the expectation was you would contract these other guys?
Yeah, they called me to arrange, and I would, it got to the point where I said, these are the guys that we're doing,
yeah,
or I'm not going to do it, you know, because it just, one, we'd been playing since Hawaii, you know, Gary and I, Larry Williams, and Kim Hutchcroft, and then Bill Reichenbach, who was playing trombone on most everything, yeah, that I did, you know, met him early on when we first moved here, and the guy can play anything, great musician. So, you know, I just said, if I can't have these guys, I'm not interested.
Yeah, and the tightness comes from having played together a lot, and the intonation, and everybody gets. So you mentioned Bill. I know, Tom, I need to go off track here for a second, because I had this thing twice so far in our show. We have marveled at, as you mentioned, some of the Giroux stuff. We have absolutely marveled at what you did with Giroux's Love Is Real. It was in our, we did a list of top 10 solos, not guitar, and I presented that one as a scat solo. And then when we talked to Jay Graydon, we asked him questions about how this went together, and he told us about how Al would do the scat first, and then Jay took the selects and built a comp out of that. And then I want to play this real quick so that people on the YouTube devices can hear it. But then I kind of want to hear about how this went about, because it's a little bit different for you. It's got the muted trumpet. He tells us that Bill Reichenbach was heavily involved. I'm going to play it, and then I'll let you kind of give us the play-by-play after the fact.
So that was, the session was with myself, Chuck Finley, and Bill Reichenbach. That was the first of the Graydon productions that we had done. And so I just, you know, I heard this solo, and it's like, you know, okay, let me just take that off and see if Jay likes us playing along with that. So it's, and it's kind of early on in my writing days, and that was a hand written out solo of like my chicken scratching. So, you know, and it's a lot of inflections and a lot of,
yeah,
like phrasing and the whole gamut of phrasing trumpet playing is in that solo.
And you, did Bill Reichenbach play a trumpet on that or something like that? Jay said something to the regard that he had the ability to do those difficult articulations.
I'll get to that.
Okay.
So I brought it in. I said, Jay, I wrote out the solo. He says, but, you know, maybe do it in harmon mutes. He says, well, let me hear it. So I got this, you know, handwritten pencil chicken scratching part of that solo. And Chuck Finley and I, we're both playing it, and it's doubled on the trumpet. So there's actually four trumpets in harmon mutes playing that.
All with mutes.
Okay. All harmon mutes. And Chuck basically played it perfect, reading it down. It was. Wow.
Which one is the harmon mute? I'm sorry to break in. Which one is the harmon? Is that
like
the
like Miles Davis mute, sort of? You okay. Know?
Yes. Okay.
So, yeah, Chuck was amazing on that. I mean, besides the fact that he's reading my horrible writing and, you know, having to play this really intense solo with all of these, you know, articulations, you know, because I knew it, I could play it. I bet we didn't spend more than 10 minutes on that.
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy. So back to Bill. So
okay.
We were, we had done a rough take of a chart just so Jay can hear, you know, where I'm taking it. Not this chart necessarily, but it may be distracted, maybe. So we played it down, rough mistakes and everything. And I went in with Jay, you know, we're talking about it. And he hears trumpet and trombone out in the studio playing. And they're playing one of the licks or something from the record they were playing. And Jay goes, oh, that sounds awesome. And I said, yeah, that's Chuck playing trombone and Bill playing trumpet.
Whoa. Whoa, so they flipped. I got you.
Chuck plays great trombone, and Bill can play any brass instrument known to man.
Yeah, that's what Jay said. So. Yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
So that might be an example of what we refer to at the outset of Jerry Hay Beast Mode. There is a video, isn't there, John, going around is it labeled Jerry Hay Beast Mode?
Well, yeah, it's a YouTube thing, and he strings together. It's a guy that it's audio, but he on YouTube strings together what he thinks are some of your most outrageous moments. He's got like wild women from Wongo right. in there from the tubes and but crazy stuff.
The man. Flip side to of that, maybe not flip side, but maybe counterpart complimentary, is we also marvel at your ability, or we're going to find out whose ability, to write these counter melodies that really establish a song. For example, Turn Your Love Around by George Benson. And we've heard the famous stories about how the song was written. We won't get into all that crap. I'm dying to know, knowing that story, you know, Jay comes up with this hook in this moment of inspiration, turn your love around.
Space.
I can show you how. To me, there's like nothing to it until the horn part's put in.
You got to sing the horn parts.
Turn your love around. Don't you turn me down. I can show you how. Turn your love around.
So how did that get written? How did that get developed? And what was your role in that?
That's another good story with Jay that he gave me the tune, you know, the track of the tune, you know, come up with a horn part. And Jay spends a lot of time. He's very meticulous on his guitar parts, making sure that the part is really great and in time and, you know, everything. So I come in and I said, I got a pretty good part for the chorus. He goes, what is it? And I sang it to him. And he goes, you're kidding. He said, that's almost verbatim what his guitar part was.
No way. Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah. So So, and the horns won out.
Perfect. Oh, man.
I mean, it is. We say it's one of those songs you absolutely cannot sing the chorus without singing the horns. And the same was true with, what was the other song from that album that he did? George Benson's Never Give Up on a Good Thing. Never give up on a good thing. Remember what makes you happy. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Never give up on a good thing. If love is what you got, you got. You cannot sing the chorus without your horn part.
Oh, thank you. That's one of the things that I try to do. I always say that I look at, if you can have the name of the chorus followed by the horns so that people associate the horns with the tune, like "All You Need Is Love," you know, that's the perfect example for me. Or in the worst case scenario is "Sweet Caroline," you know?
Yeah.
As bad as that is.
Yeah.
It's great. Cause you know, that's the hook. And that, and then you got horns, you know, horns embedded in people's mind. So that's one thing that I try to do is associate the horns with the.
Well, we're not exactly following the chronology in this two-part episode with Jerry Hay, although kind of close to it. So starting with Sea Wind, right, and making our way up to and through the Giroux and Benson eras.
Yeah, I think there's still a little bit of meat left on the bone, as they say.
Yes, there is.
I did want to pause and just kind of picture that so many of these artists talk about playing and being discovered at the Baked Potato. That tiny little club there in L.A., I don't know if you've ever looked it up and seen pictures of it. It is so tiny. The stage is tiny. You're cramped. The sound in it is terrible, but it is legendary for these guys to play in.
It really is. Yeah. I think Mark Jordan also made a reference to the playing the Baked Potato.
Yeah. Porcaro and Luke have talked about it all the time. Greg Matheson tells all kinds of stories online about his days at the Baked Potato.
Yep. I'm getting hungry. We better get to this lightning round.
Get some, you know, sour cream out.
Right? I am Irish. I like me a good potato. All right. Shall we segue?
Strike it.
It's not exactly the sound effect you would use for a segue now that I think about it. It's kind of abrupt.
No, but it does grab your attention.
It does. So well,
that's good.
All right. Well, how are you going to grab our attention? What have you found at sea?
Found at sea. I just am so enamored with Jerry's arrangements, obviously. So I want to focus on a few of those, and I'm going to go right in the pocket here. This is during the Foster era, 1980, with Earth, Wind, and Fire. And man, just check out this track, Pride, from the album Faces.
Ooh, that's a smoker there.
Fire.
Yeah. What I love how tight the horn section's able to stick with the snare drum on those syncopations. Isn't it amazing?
Oh, it's like, you feel like it's one horn, even though you know it's at least four, probably double tracked. And so that's the magic of what Jerry did. It is unlike any other in his, I mean, other people can play tight, but he forced those guys and himself into playing something that is, the difficulty level is so high and the tightness level required to do that is so high. And then in the upper range, which is harder and harder to play, you know, precisely. And he just pushed the limits of what a horn can do.
Yep. Well, come back for part two where I will abase myself in that very mode there when we talk about Thriller.
Okay.
Remember I say, I always, when I was little, thought that could have just been
synth horns?
Oh, now you ruined it. Now no one's got to come back.
Oh, all right. Okay.
All right. Well, I say other things, too, that are clever and fun and unique. So yeah, come back do. For part two. All right. All right. What have I found at sea, you ask?
What do you found at sea, I've asked?
Thank you for asking. This is a discovery. So are you familiar with Heat? So they're not the Swedish group Heat, but Heat, 1980.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, they came out with a new song in 2023, which maybe you saw. And that is what I found at sea, because it's got some yacht vibes to it. It's called Put Your Trust in Love, and this is with Horn Engine, which is another nickname you might use for Jerry Hay. Interesting. That's cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what I knew I loved it. What I didn't know about it was that the song was actually based on or inspired by a song from that 1980 album, their debut album on MCA. And they call it a two-stepper. I don't know why. But this song is actually a buried treasure because it's got all the goods, as the aforementioned Mr. Grady would like to say.
Yep.
And this is called This Love That We Found.
You know, my takeaway is a little bit of a Manhattan Transfer in that. Yeah, the vocal assembly. Yeah.
I was thinking Earth, Wind, and Fire, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Both of which feature horns, so that's why it's somewhat relevant. I'm going to try to shoehorn, shoehorn all of my lightning round into the theme today. All right, what do you have as a buried treasure?
I'm going back to the same album, Faces, Earth, Wind, and Fire. The song I'm going to play is Back on the Road, and we are going to eventually listen to the solo. The solo is credited to Luke Ather, and it's full-on Luke. But I'm trying to figure out what is going on in this intro, because if it's uncredited, but if you were to guess, who might you say this sounds like? You think that's Luke, or is that Eddie Van Halen buried treasure on that song? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good question. I almost heard a little of Boston, too.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Well, all right, let's hear the solo. So Luke giving us some of the Running with the Night vibe on that tune, man.
So you're saying that was probably Take Zero, huh?
Could be. Yeah. Probably not. If Foster was producing, or if he was even in the building, there's no way that Take Zero was getting by.
Yeah, no such thing. It could have been Take Zero, but there was also 30 other ones at the...
Yes, truth.
All right. Very nice. Very nice. Oh, so Bear, that was your buried treasure?
Yeah, so I guess that means I get to go off the map, snake draft style, right?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Jerry Hay did an arrangement for Dirty Loops, and this is 2014. The album is called Loopified, and I'm just going to go to the end of this one because this is beast mode. Here we go. This is Jerry Hay, beast mode. The way she looks like Superman's kryptonite.
Yes.
And the bass in that. Jeez.
That is beast mode.
Everybody went beast mode on that. Every player in the band was going beast mode.
Okay, I'm glad you said so, because I want you to put a pin in that for next week. That's a good reason to come back to episode two.
Right.
My off the map will be a mirror image to this off the map.
Okay.
All right. Beast mode. So, my off the map is not beast mode. I made a discovery this week, not this week, but recently, when Jacob Collier, whose name somehow manages to come up an awful lot on a Yacht Rock podcast.
Yeah.
His new collab features Michael McDonald.
Oh.
And the band Lawrence. I did not know who Lawrence was.
I did, but I did not know about this tune.
Oh, what a happy discovery this is. At least some of their albums are just top-notch. In the sort of yachty realm, not yacht rock, but certainly close enough to be off the map, features some good horns. This is kind of why I'm bringing it in, because the modern artists, I mean, Jerry Hay has left a legacy that artists to this day, I think, whether they're specifically trying to emulate it or just by osmosis have just... whatever.
Yeah, they're definitely using it, even if they don't know where it came from.
Exactly. Yeah. So this has got some palm mutes and some roads. This is off their 2017 album, Lawrence's Breakfast. The song is called
Do You Want to Do Nothing With Me? Do you want to do nothing with me? Do you want to do nothing with me? Do you want to do nothing with me?
They know their chords for some young chitlins, man. They know their chords.
You know what's cool about Lawrence? Go back and listen. You're exactly right. So this is the assignment to the listeners. They will take a very simple progression, like 1-4-1-4-1-4, but they'll go 1-4-1-4-1, like maybe add 9 to the 4 or something. They put all these little interesting interlude chords that kind of keep you guessing. It's so cleverly done.
And she can sing, man. There's some stuff on the first album. Woo.
Yeah.
Fire.
Woo doggy.
Yep.
All right. Well, you know what that means.
I do remember how to do it this time.
We'll see.
Okay, here we go. Ahoy.